Blog Talk Radio.
GoDamnMedia.com.
And good evening, everybody, and welcome to the Red Fox Blogger with your host, Cal Fritzy. I'm having a really good week. I couldn't have a better week. I think the top banner of my week was that I got a magic mouse. All right, that's enough. Yeah, but you know you really lead a boring life when the highlight of your week is that your magic mouse arrived in the mail. But this thing is really nifty. I've been playing with it all week. Does all sorts of neat things. But how are you? All right. Like I say, enough of nonsensicals from Kel. But it is Friday. That should be enough to have everybody in a good mood. The weekend is upon us, and it's supposed to be a very nice one out there. So I hope you're all prepared for the barbecues. But what we want to discuss tonight, well, not so pleasant, isn't it? No. And, of course, that's Islam. These stories of Islam, they, you know, the hits just keep on coming with this cult, doesn't it? And I've got a few in here, and I want to share them with you. I want to talk about them not being very, very patriotic when they join the military, the American military in particular. They are indeed soldiers of Allah. They are not soldiers of the United States of America. I want to get into that. It's breathtaking just how far gone into this cult these adherents go. I also want to share with you an article by Becky Noble. I'm going to share that with you near the end of the program. It doesn't have anything to do with Islam, but it does have a punch to it, and I think you'll enjoy that. However, yeah, this is an article. I actually was listening to the Mark Levin show this week, and he had a guest host on. His first name is Brian. I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with the names of the guest hosts for the principal radio hosts, but the guest hosts filling in for Mark Levin, Brian. He had this article on the show. It's by Michelle Malkin, and you can actually find it in the National Review. It's from August 30th, actually. So if you go to the National Review, just look up Michelle Malkin, Soldiers of Allah, Not America. So I'm listening to Mark Levin with the guest host, Brian. He's discussing this article, and I really wanted to share it with you folks in case some of you may not get Mark Levin. I know a lot of my listeners in Europe and Canada probably don't. I know a lot of my American patriots certainly enjoy Mark Levin, so you might have heard it. I want to reiterate it. It is that good. Soldiers of Allah, Not America. Now, a military jury, they sentenced unrepentant Fort Hood jihadist Nidal Hussein to death on Wednesday last week, right? We know that. But if another murderous Muslim soldier's case is any indication, Hassan may be sitting in the catbird seat for years to come. And our men and women in uniform will remain endangered by Islamic vigilantes in their own ranks. She recites a couple of stories here, some that we might have forgotten about, but what I want to remind you of. Do you remember Sergeant Hassan Akbar? Do you remember him? He's the one on March 23rd of 2003, this hate-filled soldier with the 32-6 Engineer Battalion. He lobbed stolen hand grenades and shot his M4 automatic rifle into three tents filled with sleeping commanding officers at the 101st Airborne Division's 1st Brigade Operations Center in Kuwait. Do you remember him? The grenade attack claimed the lives of two American patriots, Captain Christopher Sheriff, Seifert, and Major Gregory Stone. Do you remember that? That was by Sergeant Hassan Akbar on March 23rd of 2003. Now, like Hassan, the militant Muslim Akbar, he gave plenty of notice that he was a threat to his fellow servicemen. His bosses picked him as a menace with an attitude problem well before the fragging. Despite several incidents of insubordination and prior invocation of his Islamic beliefs to skip out of the 1991 Gulf War, Akbar's superiors dispatched him to Kuwait on the eve of the invasion of Iraq and put him in charge of clearing landmines. Sensitivity trumped soldier safety. Yeah, you read that right. Sensitivity trumped the safety of our soldiers, the American soldier. This guy was in a lot of trouble in the past. Insubordination, attitude problems. He was pegged as a menace. Yet they still dispatched him to Kuwait. Yeah. To be in charge of clearing landmines. Yeah, isn't that lovely? Now, at Akbar's court-martial, prosecutors read vengeful quotes from his diary in which he vowed, "I am going to try and kill as many of them as possible, and my life will not be complete unless America is destroyed." Eyewitnesses said that after his arrest, he inveighed against his fellow troops. "You guys are coming into our countries and you're going to rape our women and kill our children. And here we go again. Huh. Where had we heard that one? As of late. Yeah. Nid al-Hassan. I'm going to halt the article for a minute and tell you what I feel about these things when I hear them. And I will reiterate what I say when I hear these things, when I read them. Muslims do not belong in Western militaries. They don't belong at all. They have proven themselves not to be trusted, not to be entrusted. They are answerable to no earthly entity. They are answerable only to Allah. We are seeing more and more of this. Now, this is the soldier of Allah. This is not a soldier of America. He was sentenced to death in April of 2005 on two counts of premeditated murder and 17 counts of premeditated attempted murder. But you know, Hassan Akbar, unlike his victims, he's still alive. And so does his Quran-inspired hatred of our soldiers. Apparently, this was a pathology addressed specifically in the slide presentation Nid al-Hassan gave to his colleagues at Walter Reed Army Hospital. Boy, I'm telling you. As Michelle Malkin reported exclusively during the trial, Akbar, he stole a pair of scissors, and he stabbed an attending MP in the shoulder and neck. And the judge downplayed the new attack as an opportunistic stabbing. Meanwhile, Akbar's lawyers are using every opportunity to exploit the legal system. 8 years after his sentencing and 10 years after his jihad attack, Akbar's case remains on appeal. And it is likely headed for the Supreme Court. And even after that, no execution will take place until the president gives it the green light. Now think about that. Until the president gives it the green light. Do you think President Barack Hussein Obama will? I'm not really sure. Because, see, Obama, he's a funny one to figure out, isn't he? We know that he is pro-Islam, definitely. My feeling, death penalty be carried out, it'll be because he is enabling these jihadists to reach their paradise sooner, as opposed to languishing in solitary confinement for years. However, many dhimmis will see him as a president who is pro-death penalty. And we know that there are a lot of liberals out there who are against the death penalty. Of course, personally, I think Obama is too. But I just want you to chew on that one. Think about it. If Obama does indeed grant that the death penalty be carried out, will he be doing it because he feels justice will finally be served? Or is he doing it to enable his co-religionists to reach his paradise sooner? So there you go. Now I can guarantee you there's a snowball's chance in hell that the Obama administration, which deemed Nid al-Hassan's jihad at Fort Hood a workplace of violence, he will be rushing to send Akbar to meet his 72 virgins anytime soon. This is the opinion of the author of the article. She doesn't seem to think he'll do it. Me? Well, if he does, you know why I think he would. But you know what? Despite the blood red flags and warnings of these soldiers of Allah, our feckless feds have done little to prevent the next Nid al-Hassan or Hassan Akbar from striking again. there are past Al-Qaeda linked Muslim soldiers inside the USA military, and that includes Army soldier Ali Muhammad, who pleaded guilty to conspiring with Osama bin Laden to attack any Western target in the Middle East, and admitted his role in the 1998 African embassy bombings. We have Naval Reservist Semi Osman, who was linked to a terrorist training camp in Oregon. Jeffrey Leon Battle, an Army Reservist who pled guilty to conspiring to levy war against the United States. Navy Sailor Hassan Abu Jihad, and yeah, you read that right. You heard that right. I'm reading it right. You're not reading it, I'm reading it, but you heard it right. Hassan Abu Jihad, who was convicted on espionage and material terrorism support charges after serving abroad, the USS Benfold, and sharing classified information with Al-Qaeda financiers, including movements of U.S. ships just 6 months after Al-Qaeda operatives had killed 17 Americans aboard the USS Cole in the port of Yemen. U.S. Army Private First Class Nasser Jason Abdu, an overt anti-American agitator who plotted to kill his fellow soldiers and to get even with the military and strike at Kafirs, meaning us, the non-Muslim. The common thread, guys, tying these infiltrators together? Nidal Hassan spelled it out for his deaf, dumb, and willfully blind military superiors. We love death more than you love life. He recommended that the military allow Muslim soldiers the option of being released to increase troop morale and to decrease adverse events. However, Hassan's report was ignored by his superiors and excluded from his trial, and it goes unheeded at the Pentagon today. Political correctness is an American soldier of Allah's best friend. Now, I'm in the studio. I'm just going to go into the chat room, make sure you guys can hear me. Oh, yep. And it looks like you can hear me fine. And I've got people in there. And I want to say hi to Iggy Mom, Kath, Doc, Vorp, Holger, Poppy. Hi, guys. How you doing? So good. Good. Everybody can hear me fine. I got a little memo here from Blog Talk Radio. This is why I wanted to jump back in the studio. All issues with voice dropping have been resolved. If you see anything at all, please report using the help tab in the studio, the Blog Talk Radio team. So, yay. However, once bitten, twice shy. As everybody here knows, we were having quite the issues, the radio host last week, but it seemed as of Sunday, everything seems to have cleared up, and I listen to a lot of Blog Talk Radio, and all the radio hosts seem to have absolutely no issues this week. So it looks like Blog Talk Radio, they were on top of things. They seem to have gotten everything sorted, so I'm glad for that. My show on Monday afternoon, it went well without any problems, that's good. Good for Blog Talk Radio. Do we get a monthly refund? You did that for us the last time. We'll wait and see. But for now, it seems this week has gone swimmingly for all the radio hosts. So thank you, Blog Talk Radio, for getting all the issues straightened out for us. Okay, I'm switching gears here. But do you? I'm sure you do. But I'm sure there's a lot of people out there who don't know about this. But for those of you who do, recall John McCain. What was he on? I believe it was Fox and Friends. He was on there and they were discussing about Alua Akbar, And the two gentlemen from Fox News, they said to John McCain, well, I don't know if I really want to aid these people who do this. And then they showed that clip of them blowing up something, and they're all, you know, yelling, Allahu Akbar! Allahu Akbar! Well, John McCain, he had a little bit of something to say about that. And I broke it down into a 30-second soundbite. But if you have a chance, go to YouTube and watch the entire thing. But especially the look on the faces of the two interviewers when John McCain came out with this is priceless. I swear one guy literally froze. But here, just to remind you, what I'm talking about here is John McCain at his, well, not so finest.
Allahu Akbar! Allahu Akbar!
I have a problem helping those people out if they're screaming that after a hit.
Would you have a problem with American Christians saying, thank God, thank God? That's what they're saying. Come on. Of course they are Muslims, but they are moderates, and I guarantee you that they are moderates. I know them, and I've been with them. For someone to say Allah Akbar is about as offensive as someone saying thank God.
What you just said is one of the most insanely idiotic things I have ever heard. At no point in your rambling, incoherent response were you even close to anything that could be considered a rational thought. Everyone in this room is now dumber for having listened to it. I award you no points, and may God have mercy on your soul.
You're so dumb. You are really dumb.
And that was our very own, well, the very own John McCain. Yeah. I watched that probably about, I don't know, a dozen times, because the look on the faces of the interviewers, that is just absolutely priceless. Oh, man, I'm telling you. Totally switching gears. Now, everybody has Syria on their mind, right? Me, I'm having one heck of a time making sense of Syria and the history. I know a little bit, but my issue in terms of Islam is pretty much Sharia law. I really don't get into the geopolitics of Islam so much, but because Syria is really on the forefront of everybody's minds, I thought that maybe I would start looking into it. And I was talking with Poppy about that too, and I said, you know, how do we break it down? And so she found this article. It's a brilliant article. It's from the Washington Post. It's 9 questions about Syria you were too embarrassed to ask. Essentially what it is, it's Syria for dummies. Right up my alley. Yep. Now, the United States and allies are preparing for a possibility. I can't even talk. I can't read. You know that. Take 2. The United States and allies are preparing for a possible imminent series of limited military strikes against Syria, the first direct U.S. intervention in the 2-year civil war in retaliation for President Bashar al-Assad's suspected use of chemical weapons against civilians. Now, as we know, that is allegation. We do not know if Assad did this. Personally, I think the rebels are behind it. Oh, and yeah, what you just said, that clip is from Billy Madison. Yeah, so there you go. People wanted to know where'd that clip come from. You can find it on YouTube as well. Okay. You know, I'm telling you, Barack Hussein Obama doesn't know a damned thing about Benghazi, right? But he's just absolutely right on top, dead bang on positive that Assad is behind the Syrian gas attack. I just find that absolutely fascinating. Now, the thing is, I'm finding this a little confusing. So, like I say, this article pretty much became my best friend. So what is Syria? What is Syria exactly, right? Well, Syria is a country in the Middle East, along the eastern shore of the Mediterranean Sea. It is about the same size as Washington State, with a population a little over three times as large, at 22 million. Syria is very diverse, ethnically and religiously, but most Syrians are ethnic Arab and follow the Sunni branch of Islam. Civilization in Syria goes back thousands of years, but the country as it exists today is very young. Its borders were drawn by European colonial powers in the 1920s. Syria is in the middle of an extremely violent civil war. Fighting between government forces and rebels have killed more than 100,000 and created 2 million refugees. Half of them are children. Okay, so there we got a little bit of a history about what exactly Syria is. But another question people ask is, why are people in Syria killing each other? And just hold on. Had to hit my cough button and get my water. Okay, so why are people in Syria killing each other? Well, the killing started in April of 2011, when peaceful protests inspired by earlier revolutions in Egypt and Tunisia rose up to challenge the dictatorship running the country. The government responded, and there is no getting around this, like monsters. First, security forces quietly killed activists. Then they started kidnapping, raping, torturing, and killing activists and their family members, including a lot of children, dumping their mutilated bodies by the side of the road. Then troops began simply opening fire on protesters. Eventually, civilians started shooting back. Fighting escalated from there until it was a civil war. Armed civilians organized into rebel groups. The army deployed across the country, shelling and bombing whole neighborhoods and towns, trying to terrorize people into submission. They've also allegedly used chemical weapons, which is a big deal for reasons that we will address a little later. Volunteers from other countries joined the rebels, either because they wanted freedom and democracy for Syria, or more likely, because they are jihadists who hate Syria's secular government. The rebels were gaining ground for a while, and now it looks like Assad is coming back, and there seems to be no end in sight. Now, I find that interesting, just what he said in this article, is that the rebels infested with jihadists. Yeah, clearly we know that. There's got to be, what are there, 8 or 9 rebel groups running around in Syria now? Who knows who the jihadists are? And we know what jihadists are capable of, the Islamists. Now, are some of the rebels honestly looking for democracy from a tyrannical government? Or are there actually jihadists within the rebel ranks who oppose Syria's secular government? Which brings us back to a query I have. Who's capable of unleashing sarin gas on women and children? A secular dictatorship, as bad as it is, or jihadists embedded within the rebel forces? Now, it is horrible, but there are a lot of protests. There are a lot of them going on. How did it go so wrong in Syria? How did it go so wrong? Well, that's a complicated question, and there's no single definitive answer. This is the shortest possible version. You might say, broadly speaking, that there are two general theories. Both start with the idea that Syria has been a powder keg waiting to explode for decades, and that it was set off, maybe inevitably, by the 2011 protest and especially by the government's overly harsh crackdown. Before we dive into theories, though, you have to understand that the Syrian government really overreacted when peaceful protests started in mid-2011. slaughtering civilians unapologetically, which was a big part of how things escalated as quickly as they did. Assad learned from his father. In 1982, Assad's father and then dictator, Hafiz al-Assad, responded to a Muslim Brotherhood-led uprising in the city of Hama by leveling entire neighborhoods. He killed thousands of civilians, many of whom had nothing to do with the uprising. But it worked, and it looks like the younger Assad tried to reproduce it. His failure made the descent into chaos much worse. Now, how about the theories for why Syria spiraled so wildly? The first of what you might call sectarian rebalancing, or the Fareed Zakaria case, for why Syria is imploding? Syria has artificial borders that were created by European colonial powers, as I mentioned, forcing together an amalgam of diverse religious and ethnic groups. These powers also tended to promote a minority and rule through it, worsening pre-existing sectarian tensions. Zakaria's argument is that what we're seeing in Syria is in some ways the inevitable rebalancing of power along ethnic and religious lines. He compares it to the sectarian bloodbath in Iraq after the United States toppled Saddam Hussein, after which a long-oppressed majority retook powers from and violently punished the former minority rulers. Now, most Syrians are Sunni Arabs, but the country is run by members of a minority sect known as Alawites. They're the ethnic Arab group, but follow a smaller branch of Islam. That is the Alawites, ethnic Arab who follow a smaller branch of Islam. The Alawite government rules through a repressive dictatorship and gives Alawites special privileges, which makes some Sunnis and other groups hate Alawites in general, which in turn makes Alawites fear that they'll be slaughtered en masse if Assad loses the war. There are other minorities as well, such as ethnic Kurds and Christian Arabs. This is too much, I know, to cover in one explainer, but we'll get through it. Where was I? Also, lots of Syrian communities are already organized into ethnic or religious enclaves, which means that community militias are also sectarian militias. That would explain why so much of the killing in Syria has developed along sectarian lines. It would also suggest that there is not much anyone can do to end the killing because, in Zakaria's view, this is a painful but unstoppable process of rebalancing power. And this is what Barack Hussein Obama wants us to walk into. Just reading that little bit will make you understand that this Syria is unsalvageable. They are fighting along sectarian lines. They are fighting along ethnic lines. They are fighting along religious lines. Barack Hussein Obama running in there and dropping a few bombs on what he would hopefully be military strategic zones will fail miserably. Now, there is a second theory here. It's a little more simple, and that is that the Assad regime was not a sustainable enterprise, and it's clawing desperately on its way down. Most countries have some kind of self-sustaining political order, and it looked for a long time like Syria was held together by a cruel and repressive but basically stable dictatorship. But maybe it wasn't stable. Maybe it was built on quicksand. Bashar al-Assad's father, Hafez, seized power in a coup in 1970 after 2 decades of extreme political instability. His government was the product of Cold War meddling and a kind of Arab political identity crisis that was sweeping the region. But he picked the losing sides of both. The Soviet Union was his patron, and he followed a hardline anti-Western nationalist ideology that's now mostly defunct. But the Cold War is long over, and most of the region long ago made peace with Israel and the United States. The Assad regime's once solid ideological and geopolitical identity is hopelessly outdated. But Bashar al-Assad, who took power in 2000 when his father died, never bothered to update it. So when things started going belly up 2 years ago, he didn't have much to fall back on except for his ability to kill people, which is true. He tried to take the same formulae that his father used in the 19, you know, well over 30 years ago, give or take. That same formulae is not working for him today. Now that Russia, this leads us into Russia. Russia and Iran, what is their deal with Syria? I was always of a wandering mind about that as well. Well, Russia is Syria's most important ally. We know that. Moscow blocks the United Nations Security Council from passing anything that might hurt the Assad regime, which is why the United States has to go around the United Nations if it wants to do anything. Russia sends a lot of weapons to Syria that makes it easier for Assad to keep killing civilians and will make it much harder if the outside world ever wants to intervene. Now, the four big reasons that Russia wants to protect Assad, the importance of which vary depending on whom you ask, I guess, is one, Russia has a naval installation in Syria, which is strategically important, and Russia's last foreign military base outside the former Soviet Union. Two, Russia still has a bit of a Cold War mentality, as well as a touch of national insecurity, which makes it care very much about maintaining one of its last military alliances. Three, Russia also hates the idea of international intervention against countries like Syria because it sees this as a Cold War-style Western imperialism and ultimately a threat to Russia. And four, Syria buys a lot of Russian military exports, and Russia needs the money. Yeah, that's right. Syria is Russia's biggest... What's the phrase I'm looking for? Syria is a big customer. I'm sorry, I had the phrase in my head. It sounded a little more coherent, but I lost it. It ran away on me. But Syria, yes, it's a buying state. Syria buys a lot of stuff from Russia. Russia wants to protect that part of their economy. Now, Iran's thinking in supporting Assad is a little more straightforward. It perceives Israel and the United States as existential threats and uses Syria to protect itself, shipping arms through Syria to the Lebanon-based military group Hezbollah and the Gaza-based militant group Hamas. Iran is already feeling isolated and insecure. It worries that if Assad falls, it will lose a major ally and be cut off from its militant proxies, leaving it very vulnerable. Yeah, that is true. Yeah, just to reiterate that. Iran is already feeling isolated and insecure, and it worries that if Assad falls, it will lose a major ally and be cut off from its militant proxies, leaving it very vulnerable. But you know what? So far, it looks like that Iran is actually coming out ahead. Assad is even more reliant on Tehran than he was before the war started. So looks like Iran has a little bit of little more clout than it's giving itself credit for, it would appear. It feels bleak and hopeless, though. It's almost like, hey, I want to take a music break. But it gets much worse. Oh, boy. I am going to take a break in about 5 minutes, though. Give you guys a chance to refresh your teeth and give me a chance to catch my breath. Now, once again, the question always comes up. Why hasn't the United States fixed this yet? Well, it can't. There's no options. The military options, they're all bad. Shipping arms to rebels, even if it helps them topple Assad, would ultimately empower the jihadists and worsen rebel infighting, probably leading to lots of chaos and possibly a second civil war. Now, you'll recall that the United States, they made this mistake during Afghanistan's early 1990s civil war, which helped the Taliban take power in 1996. Taking out Assad somehow would probably do the same, opening up a dangerous power vacuum. Launching airstrikes or a no-fly zone could suck the United States in, possibly for years, and probably wouldn't make much difference on the ground. An Iraq-style ground invasion would, in the very best outcome, accelerate the killing, cost a lot of U.S. lives, wildly exasperate anti-Americanism in a boon to jihadists and nationalist dictators alike, and would require the United States to impose order for years across a country full of people trying to kill each other. So, nope, no way. The one political option, which the Obama administration has been pushing for, would be for the Assad regime and the rebels to strike a peace deal. But there's no indication that either side is interested in that, or that there's even a viable unified rebel movement with which to negotiate. It's possible that there was a brief window for a Libya-style military intervention early on in the conflict. But the thing is, we will never really know. And Eric just walked in the room. Hi, Eric. Lots of questions here to be asked. Lots of things we don't understand. Lots of things whereas the outcome will not be very good. And this is a question, too, from the article. Why would Obama bother with strikes that no one expects to actually solve anything? Why would he want to go in there if it's not going to solve anything? Well, we're asking here about the Obama administration's not-so-subtle signals that it wants to launch some cruise missiles at Syria, which would be punishment for what it says, Assad's use of chemical weapons against civilians. Like I say, that's up in the air. Nobody can agree on that. And Lady Michelle, hello, Lady Michelle. Sorry, guys. I'm here all alone. I've got something to my ear, and I can't type with one hand, so I'm just audibly greeting everybody. But, yeah, it's true that basically no one believes that this will turn the tide of the Syrian war, but it's important, but it's not supposed to. See? It's not supposed to. The strikes wouldn't be meant to shape the course of the war or to topple Assad, which Obama thinks would just make things worse anyway. They would be meant to punish Assad for allegedly using chemical weapons and to deter him for any future military activity, and that would go for any other military leader in any future war from using them again. So he just wants to, he's a paper tiger, essentially. Well, let's lob, a few missiles at them. Let them know we don't like them using chemical weapons. And if they don't stop it, we're going to get really angry, stomp our feet, lob in a few missiles, and maybe scare the living bejesus out of them. Well, it's not going to work. If anything, Barack Hussein Obama has done more damage on the world stage than any other president on foreign policy than I can ever think of. And the thing is that the Middle East knows how inept he is, and they are simply laughing at him. And by his tactics alone shows that he's weak. He's very weak. He's laughable, unfortunately. We all get labeled as weak and laughable in the West. Obama has single-handedly, through his ineptitude, made the entire West a laughingstock in the Middle East. Now, a lot of people ask, what's the big deal about chemical weapons? Well, the thing is, Assad, he kills 100,000 people with bullets and bombs. And people are getting freaked out over 1,000 who maybe died from poisonous gas. And a lot of people think, well, that seems silly. And why are we getting ourselves all in knots for that? But we would certainly not be the only ones who thinks the distinction is arbitrary and artificial. But there's a good case to be made that this is a rare opportunity, at least in theory, for the United States to make the war a little bit less terrible and to make future wars less terrible. The whole idea is that there are rules of war. It's a pretty new one. The practice of war is thousands of years old, but the idea that we can regulate war to make it less terrible has been around for less than a century. The institutions that do this are weak and inconsistent. The rules are frail and not very well observed. But one of the world's few quasi-successes in the norm, a fancy way of saying a rule we all agree to follow against chemical weapons, is there. But this norm is frail enough that Syria could drastically weaken it if we ignore Assad's use of them. But it's also strong enough that it's worth protecting. So it's sort of like low-hanging fruit. Firing a few cruise missiles doesn't cost as much and can maybe help preserve this really hard-won and valuable norm against chemical weapons. But like I say, long shot, long shot. Now, if we had had a president like Ronald Reagan, yeah, I can see some modicum of success, but I certainly don't see it under Barack Hussein Obama. So for me, this argument really, it's not working for me. Okay, what time is it? Okay. I'm past break time. There's a little more in here I want to share with you. It's very, very lengthy, though. I've got about maybe 5 minutes more in it. Maybe I'll just finish it off, and then I'll take a break. But like I say, that question, it remains unanswered. How do we preserve the norm against chemical weapons? How do we do it? Not why we should. Yeah, of course we should. We should preserve our morale in that chemical weapons simply cannot be used. But how do we do it? War is going to happen. It just is. But the reason that the world got together in 1925 for the Geneva Convention to ban chemical weapons is because this stuff is really, really good at killing civilians, but not actually very good at the conventional aim of warfare, which is to defeat the other side. You may say that there's maybe a 30% of a battlefield weapon and 70% a tool of terror. 30% at the battlefield of weapons, but 70% tools of terror. In a world without that norm against chemical weapons, a military might fire off some sarin gas because it wants that battlefield advantage, even if it ends up causing unintended and massive suffering among civilians, maybe including its own. And if a military believes its adversary is probably going to use chemical weapons, it has a strong incentive to use them itself. After all, they're fighting to the death. So both sides of any conflict, not to mention civilians everywhere, are better off if neither of them use chemical weapons. But that requires believing that your opponent will never use them, no matter what. And the only way to do that, short of removing them from the planet entirely, is for everyone to just agree in advance to never use them and to really mean it. Now, that becomes much harder if the norm is weakened because someone like Assad got away with it. It becomes a bit easier if everyone believes using chemical weapons will cost you a few inbound U.S. cruise missiles. That's why the Obama administration apparently wants to fire cruise missiles at Syria, even though it won't end the suffering, end the war, or even really hurt Assad that much. So what's going to happen? What's going to happen next? Short term, maybe the United States and some allies will launch some limited brief strikes against Syria, and maybe they won't. Either way, these things seem pretty certain in the long term. One, the killing will continue, probably for years. There's no one to sign a peace treaty on the rebel side, even if the regime side were interested. And there's no foreseeable victory for either. Refugees will continue fleeing into neighboring countries, causing instability and an entire other humanitarian crisis as conditions in the camps worsen. We are witnessing that in Jordan, for example. Jordan is finding the Syrian refugees to the point of being unsustainable. Two, Syria, as we know it, an ancient place with a rich and celebrated culture and history, will be a broken, failed society, probably for a generation or more. It's very hard to see how you rebuild a functioning state after this. Maybe worse, it's hard to see how you get back to a working social contract where everyone agrees to get along. Three, Russia will continue to block international action, the window for which has maybe closed anyway. The United States might try to pressure, cajole, or even horse trade Moscow into changing its mind. But there's not much we can offer them that they care about as much as Syria. And finally, four. At some point, the conflict will cool, either from a partial victory or from exhaustion. The world could maybe send in some peacekeepers or even broker a fragile peace between the various ethnic, religious, and political factions. Probably the best model is Lebanon, which fought a brutal civil war that lasted 15 years from 1975 to 1990 and has been slowly, slowly recovering ever since. It just had some bombings last week. And I want to welcome Cal Living into the chat room. Okay, I am going to take a break, but I better run down the chat room and say hello to everybody. I want to say hi to Iggy Mum, Cal Living, Kath, Doc, Eric, Thorpe, Holger, Lady Michelle, and Poppy. And, of course, you listening on other devices. Okay. I got something here. Who sent this? Somebody sent this to me. Oh, you know what, though? I get one more thing before I take a little break. How much time do I have left? Oh, boy. I just want to remind you, Holger in the chat room, he is having a show tomorrow night right here on Blog Talk Radio at 11 p.m. Eastern Time involving the topic of Islam. And believe me, the gloves are off. The Awakening, tomorrow night, 11 p.m. Eastern Time, with Holger.
On Saturday, September 7th, at 11 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, as we near the 12th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks on America by Islamic jihadis, The Awakening Show on Blog Talk Radio will discuss Islam as never before heard on Blog Talk Radio. That evening, the war on Islam will begin. This is no war on terror. This is no war on a few radicals. This is war on Islam itself. Join Holger Awakens on Saturday, September 7th, as he remembers 9/11 and speaks to the vengeance still owed to the American people, and more importantly, as the war on Islam begins, the way it should be declared and the way it should be waged. Islam, Galenta, Est.
Yeah, so try to be there. And I advise that you get there early because the premium seats, they fill up pretty fast. So if you want a front row seat, yeah, get there early. Now I'm going to take a two-minute break. I want to play something. Roger sent this to me. Roger Oberlin, he sent this to me on Facebook. I don't know what he was thinking. He must have thought I needed some cheering up or something. He said, I'm just going to share it with you. Welcome back, everybody. That is the Hen House 5 plus 2. And thank you, Roger. Oh, and they're still barking away back there. Oh, that sounded almost nasty. I just wanted to share a little bit of the whimsical side of the red fox, who is usually a mad fox. Now, what I should have done... Okay, we get the point. They're still squawking back there. What I should have done is I should have put this article in the chat room while we were on break and while I had two hands. But I'm going to do that right now. And like I say, I really want to thank Poppy for sending that to me because I was asking her for a little bit of help with this, and she came right through for me. And there you go. I have so many things in here that I could discuss. I was anticipating a round table tonight, but unfortunately my two fine gentlemen, they couldn't make it. So that's all right. I never run out of material. There are things in here, like I say, that always keep me going. I was going to share an article with you, but it's another lengthy one, and I really don't want to bore you with too many dense topics on Syria. I'm worried about what's going to happen. I'm also worried about the refugees and what we're going to do with the refugees. Apparently Sweden is taking in quite a few refugees, and so is the United States, and I think Canada has vowed to do the same. I think we're asking for trouble if we take on all of these Syrian refugees. Because first of all, we don't know who they are. We do not know who these refugees are. We do not know if they are honest civilians trying to escape the violence, escape the civil war. Well, it's turning it, which it is, I should say. Or we do not know if we're going to get infiltration, jihadist infiltration. We, every single time we take in refugees, Muslims, anywhere in any Islamic state, we get bit in the ass big time for it. Look what is happening with the Somalians in the United States. And we have the same issue here in Saskatchewan in Canada. These huge enclaves creating all sorts of problems. Look at the most famous example, of course, would be Dearborn, Michigan. Look what they are doing in that state. I have a real problem with Islamic immigration. I have, because I do not find that Islam is compatible with Western values. Now, we have an issue regarding that going on up here. The province of Quebec, they want to introduce a bill that would make the overt portrayal of religious garb or jewelry or headwear banned if you work in the public sector or if you work with children. They're not saying you can't wear it on the streets. If you want to go to the Kmart, you know, in your hijab, you know, knock yourself out. They're not doing that. They just want to curtail it in the government. If you work for the government and you're serving the public, you know, leave the turban at home. Leave the hijab. Leave it out. And you certainly are not going to be wearing a niqab. No. Well, of course, what do we get? We get the usual liberal hue and cry. We get the Muslims banging the drums. This is discrimination. This is racist. But it is what it is. Now, we all know why the province of Quebec wants to introduce this bill, and of course why it is a sweeping bill that would curtail the wearing of religious garb, headdress, jewelry, you know, like the Madonna crosses. Yeah, the Madonna crosses, they're out. But we really know why Quebec is doing this. It is because of the Muslims. Islam is not well received there. Well, Islam is not well received in the West more and more, I'm noticing. Unfortunately, everybody gets swept, well, I shouldn't say swept under the carpet, but we're certainly getting caught up in the dragnet. Let's put it that way. All religions are getting caught up in the dragnet because Islam is making noises and creating problems for the province of Quebec. This is pretty much why they're doing it. It's got to be done, though. We have got to start realizing that there are some things that are just not compatible with the West. Islam is one of them. Multiculturalism has been a huge failure. Look at what we're witnessing in England. And what was the Chancellor of Germany, Merkel? She came out and she said that, look, multiculturalism is a failed experiment. And it's true. One thing that bothers me about official multiculturalism is that officially all cultures are to be treated equal. Whereas we have to stop that. Sharia law, it's illegal. It's illegal to practice Sharia law in the West. But we have to be respectful of the culture who practices Sharia law. We're finding way too many cases of Islamists getting off with lighter sentences because we simply do not understand their culture when they engage in practices underneath the thumb of Sharia law. We have to start making steps like they're doing in Quebec. If we have to ban stuff, if it seems draconian, well, so be it. I'm with Quebec on this one. Ann Holger, thanks a lot for being here. Have a great night, and I will definitely see you on your show tomorrow night, 11 p.m. Eastern Time, for When the Gloves Come Off regarding Islam. So, time is of the essence. And we have to stop with the mosque building. There, in Virginia, for example, this week, they're going to build this big old ugly mosque in the middle of farm country. And the neighbors, they've objected to it. They don't want it. They go to the town halls and they've said, no, we don't want this. We don't want this big, huge, honking old mega mosque in the middle of our, you know, in the middle of flyover territory. What are you guys thinking? And why would they want to live in the middle of flyover territory? Anyway, don't they all mostly settle in the urban centers? Why do they want to come here? Well, I guess because they do have an Islamic population in this area. Yeah, it's the Virginia Beach area. Apparently, this little Muslim group, they've been worshiping for the past 5 years in a storefront mosque. So they want to build a bigger, you know, a real mosque. Now, this worship center proposed for a 9-acre site at Lansdowne and Salem Roads has the blessing of the city's planning commission, which recently recommended on a 10-0 vote that the city council grant a conditional use permit. Wow. This is the Crescent Community Center Core. They agreed upon some conditions. It will not have outdoor speakers or a public address system. They, you know, because they want to alleviate fears about calls to prayer echoing through the neighborhood. Nevertheless, some neighbors are dismayed, complaining that the mosque will bring traffic and noise to a mostly rural area. And it will. We know it will. They argue that the roads are too narrow and flood easily, and that a building where 225 people will worship is incompatible with horse stables, cattle grazing, and crops nearby. No one speaking before the Planning Commission suggested the mosque should be rejected because of the religion being practiced, but you know what? Of course, that's part of it. Now, the local residents, most of the disdain has been mostly expressed in letters, emails, and online forums. The vast majority, of course, are anonymous. And the writers are usually quick to espouse First Amendment rights for their own faith and words, conveniently want to pick and choose the religion protected by the Constitution. Yeah. But the thing is, the fear-mongering can't help but recall the fear in 2010 when a Muslim group in New York City that had worshipped for years in Lower Manhattan bought a vacant building two blocks from the World Trade Center site for a community center. Yeah, we can't forget that. The Victory Mosque. The Cordoba House that they wanted to build near Ground Zero. They build mosques because they are signs of victory. And they don't care pretty much where they're going to be built in the West. Just if they can go somewhere and they can get a building permit, they'll build it and they will come. Now, I'm just looking at a design here for the Crescent Community Center. Looks very nice. Lots of trees. Looks like they would preserve nature. But come on. They don't care if they plant a few trees and make it look pretty. No, that's not the whole objective behind building the Crescent Community Center in Virginia. It's because they can. Simple as that. just because they can. And they build them in all of these rather sensitive areas. They call them community centers where everybody is welcome. Now, they're mosques. And we can't go to the mosque unless we're invited. I certainly would not be welcome at a mosque. If I were a Muslima, I would still have to sit in the back. Mosques are hotbeds. They're recruiting centers for jihad. Why we have not learned that, I will never understand why the government has not acted upon that, why these mosques don't get shut down. That Boston mosque, where the Boston bombers, where they attended. As far as I know, it's still alive and kicking. The mosque where some of the 9/11 hijackers attended. As far as I know, still going strong. Why are they not controlling the people who run the mosques, and in particular the imams? Why do we need to import imams from the Middle East to run these mosques, to lead the congregation, as it were? I don't understand that. Not at all. But the government, it won't do anything. Doesn't care. Doesn't care at all. Now, at the beginning of the program, I was talking about soldier for Allah as opposed to a soldier for the United States. It's not just the Muslims that we have to worry about. There's a case in Britain, and there's some dude here. What's his name? Well, now he's Lucy Ballander. He used to be called Lawrence. And he's a former trained soldier. Swapped its territorial army beret for a veil to become Muslim's first, get this, not Muslim, sorry, to become Britain's first transgender Muslim woman. Oh, yeah, yeah. He was a former Christian soldier, converted to Islam, and got a sex change. Good luck with all that, buddy. I have a clip here. I wonder if I should play it. Here. Maybe I will just for kicks. I am down. I got some programming notes I got to get through, so I hope this isn't very long, but they have him on the news. They have him on Daybreak. Let's see what he has to say. I wonder if I'm going to get a pop-up, though.
One night we'll get in the back.
Oh, yeah, I got a pop-up, but that's okay. I got that mute button. Oh, and I got a cat here, too. Hi, Freya. How you doing, baby? How you doing? Yeah, can you wait a minute? I'll get it in a minute for you, honey. Yeah, Lucy Ballander, 28. Oh, and he was married, too. Well, he's divorced now. But let's see what he has to say.
Remember when I went out the first time and out my door and everybody sort of laughed at me and had so much trouble. You know, people sort of call you tranny. When it's like snowing and piece of swift their cars and when that ice flick ice at you.
You just want to be able to live your life.
I just want to live my life like a human being and be treated like a human being.
He wants to be treated like a human being. You heard that right. Well, I've kind of been rambling on the last 40 minutes, and my apologies. I was expecting a roundtable tonight, and it didn't develop. I was doing a little bit of scrambling. So if I sounded like I was jumping here and there and everywhere, well, I was. That's all right, though. I got through it. But I am down to my last 10 minutes of talking before I do have to bail out of here. And I just want to share with you a few programming. Oh, actually, you know what? I'm not done. I am not done at all. No. I have something here I want to share with you. Yes. And I'm just bringing it up now. I go to this blog called The Conservative Cauldron. It's in my blog world, too. If you want to visit my blog at redfoxblogger.com, please go. Bonnie, okay, it really is time for me to shut up. My friend Becky Noble, she is the proprietor of this blog, The Conservative Cauldron, and she wrote this article this week. Now, it's a very short article, but it's fantastic writing and very succinct to some of the issues that we deal with when we have children or we have young people who seem to have a sense of entitlement. It's called, I put the link in the show highlights so you can go right to it. It's from September 4th. It's Labor Day and the Entitlement Generation. Now, Americans celebrated Labor Day this week. Sorry about that. The last blast of summer, with barbecues, swimming, and the kids bemoaning, if they hadn't already, their return to school. The meaning of this day is to pause and reflect on the true backbone of this country, the American worker. Hard work is what built America, plain and simple. When the first settlers arrived in their new land, they knew it would take everything they had in them to survive, and survive they did. Generation after generation of hardworking immigrants have arrived to this country, knowing that the sweat of his brow was his key to success and a better life for his children. We have all seen the gritty old film footage of early 20th century construction workers sitting on steel beams hundreds of feet up in the air eating lunch from a tin lunch pail. One of the most iconic American portraits is of Rosie the Riveter, as American men went overseas to defeat Hitler and the Nazis. American women took over to the factories and doing what needed to be done to help the war effort. How many times have we seen that picture of Rosie, the look of determination on her face, flashing a fairly impressive muscle? The words above her say it all. We can do it. An empowering image for women still today. But something is happening. Something is changing. America's work ethic, like so many other institutions, is being twisted. In the age of Obama, suddenly it is cool to not work. That's right, sit at home and get paid. And the truly frightening part, more and more people are hopping on the government gravy train and expecting hardworking Americans to keep on pulling that train. In a recent study by Cato Institute, in nearly every state of the union, welfare pays better than work. In some states, a lot better. In Hawaii, live in paradise, play your EBT card at night, and you've got that right. Play your EBT card right, and you can make the equivalent in benefits of $29 an hour, and that's a pretty decent gig. Is America traditionally the poster child for hard work, producing an entire generation of welfare brats who think they are entitled to what hardworking people earn because it is fair? Is it what happens when elementary schools begin to teach the merits of social justice and wealth redistribution? Is it what happens when everyone gets a trophy so that no one's self-esteem is damaged? Is it what happens when the idea of competition is deemed to be bad? And it begs the question, will a lazy nation be willing to put forth the effort to do things like work to pull itself out of an economic stagnation, or worse case scenario, defend itself against foreign invaders? Or will we just wait for someone else to do the heavy lifting? Author of the Cato Institute study, Michael Tanner, said he thought that major changes to the educational system were needed so that young people would be able to better prepare themselves for the workforce. Perhaps a major overhaul of the American work ethic would be better. So I read that, and I just thought it was brilliant. I just wanted to share that with you. I hope you enjoyed that. Like I say, that's from Becky Noble, The Conservative Cauldron, and the link is right there. Okay. I am done. A few programming notes I want to share with you. of course, I will be back here in my Monday time slot for 3 p.m. Eastern time. As you know, I tape my show twice a week, Mondays at 3 p.m. Eastern time and Friday at 7 p.m. Eastern time. But we have a few things. We're going to have a few extras for you. On Wednesday, in conjunction with other radio hosts, we're going to be doing our tributes to 9/11. I will be on Wednesday, September 11th at 3 p.m. Eastern time doing my time slot. And we've got other radio hosts. Radio Jihad Network, MP91, they'll be doing theirs. G-Ski, he'll be doing his. I believe Dana will be part of that. So there are a lot of radio hosts. Of course, In Defense of Freedom, they will be having theirs as well. So that will be on Wednesday, my time slot, like I say, this Wednesday, 3 p.m. Eastern time. And then on Thursday, Red Fox Blogger welcomes back Randy Noble of The Cross in the Desert. Randy L. Noble acts as guest host right here on Block Talk Radio once a month. He will be here, and he will be interviewing some of his guests. I'm just trying to bring it up, and stupid me, I lost my page. So my apologies for that, guys. I'm just trying to see if I can bring it up. But Randy Noble, like I say, he is an acclaimed author. He wrote a fantastic book. It was called, where did it go? I lost it. Again. I just want to get this right because I really want to do the show's justice. He writes such books as Beyond the Veil, and A Rose in Nowruz. He is a Christian helping Christians in Iran. He has two fine guests coming up this Thursday, Miriam Rastempour and Mariza Amirzadeh. They are the authors of Captive in Iran. So please try to be at Randy's show on Thursday, right here on Red Fox Blogger at 3 p.m. Eastern time. And also, on another note, just to remind you, a week from today, my guest will be Pamela Geller. That's right, right here. She will be back here on Block Talk Radio. She's been on a few shows in the past here on Block Talk Radio. So this Friday, next Friday, September 13th at 7 p.m., Pamela Geller will join me. So I hope you all can be here a week from today to be here for that. Also, on the 20th of September, right here on Block Talk Radio, 7 p.m. Friday, again, as usual, Bonnie, a Bare Naked Islam, will be my guest. So I certainly hope all of you will be able to be here for that. And I have a few other guests coming up. And, I just lost my entire chat room. Let me try that again, see if I can get it back. But anyway, that is it. Yep. Monday, I'm back. 3 p.m. Eastern time. Wednesday, 9/11 special. 3 p.m. Eastern time. Thursday, Randy L. Noble, The Cross in the Desert. 3 p.m. Eastern time. Friday, September 13th, 7 p.m. Eastern time, where my guest will be Pamela Geller. All right, guys, I'm out of here. And just to remind you, also listen to the Radio Jihad Network. And remember, it's mass Islamity. We have to stop the insanity. Guys, have a great weekend. See you Monday. Bye-bye.
I have a problem helping those people out if they're screaming that after a hit.
Would you have a problem with an American Christian saying, thank God, that's what they're saying. Come on. Of course they are Muslims, but they are moderates, and I guarantee you that they are moderates. I know them, and I've been with them. For someone to say Allah Akbar is about as offensive as someone saying, thank God.
You're so dumb. You are really dumb.